Blog Talk Radio.
While we're sitting home in our places, stuffing goodies in our faces, bitching about the television news and the price of gasoline, there's a man who was your neighbor somewhere in Southeast Asia, living in a bamboo cage and wondering what happened to the USA. He's a citizen of the free world. He's an American mother's son. He's a living contradiction. He's a shame to everyone. He ain't got no constitution, and his Bill of Rights are gone. The war's been over for 10 years now.
Good evening. Welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. This is Tenacity, also known as Terry Dodd. And here with us tonight, our historian, our resident historian, Mike Gaddy, who is a.k.a. Rebel Madman. And if you want to see his articles, you can find him at rebelmadman.com. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, good evening, Terry. I hope you're well.
I am well, and I am, I think I might have posted it. Did you hear what the president of Tunisia did?
No, I did not. I'm sorry.
He tested for COVID a goat and a piece of fruit, sent them in as though they were human tests, and they both came back positive.
He must have sent him to an American lab.
I bet he did. Man, they showed a picture of him. He had a grin on him you would not believe. He was, I mean, just like a Cheshire cat, I guess is what he would call it. So what's our topic tonight? I know you had something in mind you wanted to kind of pick up, kind of maybe take a step back from where we were last week and look at some Bill of Rights stuff, maybe Declaration of Independence stuff. I'll just give you the floor and turn you loose.
All right, Terry. Where I really would like to start, of course, we could go back much farther, but I think this is a great point when we look at American history. And May, June of 1776, a month before the Declaration of Independence, George Mason of Virginia wrote and published what was called the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And what I would like to do is to kind of take that apart tonight and maybe just clause by clause or sentence by sentence and compare that with where we are in this country today, 240, 50 years later. And I would start, of course, with number one, and I'll do it as slowly as possible. And that is, and I quote, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity. Of course, then we've got a semicolon, but I would like to discuss just that part. It says by all men are by nature equally free and independent. That's natural rights, and they have inherent rights among those natural rights, and which they enter into a state of society, which we would call, we can call our society today. But it says that these people cannot, by any compact, and we look at the Constitution, it's called a compact, a contract, or a compact, they cannot, by any written document, deprive or divest their posterity of their rights. So it's simply stated that you cannot write a law that will deprive your posterity of any of their inalienable rights. And it says, namely, moving on from the semicolon, namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Now, in today's world, if we look at today, May the 7th, the United States, how many of us are enjoying those rights? How many of those rights have been restricted or taken away by a government of our founders' creation? And we might say, well, they weren't responsible for it, but I'll take you back to Lysander Spooner, who said, be it one thing or another, this Constitution has either authorized what we have or it's been powerless to prevent it. So obviously, whatever is happening in this country today as far as the loss of our rights, it's not actually, as we could say, our Constitution hasn't prevented it. Then number two, that all power is vested, quintly derived from the people. That magistrates, and by magistrates we mean our elected officials, that was the term for back then, are their trustees and servants, and at all times are amenable to them, meaning amenable to the people, which basically says that the people are the boss of the government and not vice versa. And we need a lot of our governors could do well to understand that today. Number three is that government is or ought to be instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, nation, or community. Of all of the various modes and forms of government that is best, which is capable of producing the greatest degree of happiness and safety, and is most effectually secured against the danger of maladministration. Now, I would ask, is our government today effectually secured, are we effectually secured against the danger of maladministration of government? And the answer to that should be obvious to everyone. And then moving on from that semicolon, and that whenever any government shall be found inadequate or contrary to these purposes, a majority of the community hath an indubitable, unalienable, and indefeasible right to reform, alter, or abolish it in such manner as shall be judged most conducive to the public weal. Number four, that no man or set of men are entitled to exclusive or separate emoluments or privileges from the community. Boy, do we have any of that today? Are some people allowed to go to work while other people aren't? Are some people still being paid while other people aren't? Is anybody from Congress missed a paycheck? Then they have been given exclusive or separate emoluments or privileges from the rest of the community. Okay, but in consideration of public services, which not being descendable, neither ought the offices of magistrate, legislator, or judge be hereditary. And that was, they were trying to get rid of the hereditary rule of kings. Number five, that the legislative and executive powers of the state should be separate and distinct from the judicial branch, and yet that the members of the two first may be restrained from oppression by feeling and participating the burdens of the people. They should, at fixed periods, be reduced to a private station. What this number five has said is that we should have term limits, or what was termed in those days as rotation. And it says to return into the body or into society from which they were originally taken. Jefferson mentioned that if we take the people into and out of office, that the government will always be aware of the genius of the people. And today, Terry and listeners, if we stop and think for a moment that the common everyday person out here has any chance of ever being elected to federal office, they are absolutely out of their mind. And so we do not have a government of the people. That is an illusion. We have a government of the wealthy aristocracy, because I don't know anyone myself who could personally, like Bloomberg has done, put millions of dollars into a campaign that lasted 2 weeks and failed. The offices, the public offices, no matter how you want to look at it, and you can rationalize it away, but our offices are for sale. And then it also says, and I'm moving on with the fifth right, and it says, and the vacancies be supplied by frequent, certain, and regular elections in which all or any part of the former members to be again eligible or ineligible as the laws shall direct. Federation took care of that real well, and it said that no one could serve in any elective office for more than 3 years out of any six. Most of the states in 1787, when we had the Constitutional Convention, the majority of the states had term limits to where you could only serve one term in any elected office. I don't see how that is a bad thing, because we could do away with professional politicians. Number six, that elections of members to serve as representatives of the people in assembly ought to be free, and that all men having sufficient evidence of permanent common interest with and attachment to the community have the right of suffrage and cannot be taxed or deprived of their property for public uses without their own consent or that of their representative so elected, nor bound by any law to which they have not in like manner assented for the public good. Do we have that today? Number seven, that all power of suspending laws or the execution of laws by any authority without the consent of the representatives of the people is injurious to their rights and ought not to be exercised. Are we having the suspension of laws today or the execution of extraneous laws by authority without consent of the people? Has anyone's legislature consented to these draconian rules that are locking people down and not permitting people to operate their own businesses? Number eight, that in all capital or criminal prosecutions, a man hath the right to demand the cause and nature of his accusation to be confronted with the accusers and witnesses, to call for evidence in his favor, and to a speedy trial by an impartial jury of his vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty, nor can he be compelled to give evidence against himself, that no man be deprived of his liberty except by the law of the land or the judgment of his peers. Well, here we get to something rather interesting. And that is, I had the question of a prosecutor that I know in this state, and I asked the prosecutor what would happen if a person who had been arrested in April or March or maybe even February now demanded a speedy trial. How would that be handled? Would they be able to demand a speedy trial? And if they don't get the speedy trial in 90 days, would they be allowed to be, would they be the charges against them dropped, as is required in some states? 90 days if you request a speedy trial, 6 months in others. Because this prosecutor told me that since like mid-March, all of their hearings had just been hearings, and they had all been by remote, by TV and what have you. And you could not seat a jury with today's restrictions. So if a person demanded a speedy trial, how is the judicial system going to handle that? Are they going to violate the rights of the people and say, no, you can't have that? And I couldn't get an answer. Okay, number 8, that in all capital or criminal prosecution, man has I read that. Number 9, that excessive bail ought not to be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Number 10, that general warrants whereby any officer or messenger may be commended to search or commanded, to search suspected places without evidence of a fact committed, or to seize any person or persons not named, or whose offense is not particularly described and supported by evidence, are grievous and oppressive and ought not to be granted. That's basically what we call today the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution, and that has been completely eviscerated by the war on drugs. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution has been destroyed by the courts, allowing government officials to enter personal property, vehicles, homes, whatever, without what is required in the Fourth Amendment, or in this, what would be the 10th of the amendments that was proposed by George Mason. So is it okay or is it not okay to suspend a person's rights because the government declares an emergency? Do we really want to go into the point to where we're going to allow the government to just declare emergency at their will and suspend everyone's right? Number 11.
Do you remember controversy? I was just I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think it's fair to throw a few things out.
It wasn't too many years ago
during the Obama administration, when they shut down a whole bunch of car dealerships. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It was only the dealerships that were owned by conservatives that were shut down, and the ones controlled by liberals were allowed to continue operating. That was a major wake-up call for me to see just how prejudicial these regulations can be out of these bureaucracies. And a friend of mine sent me a thing here, said some serious things to ponder, and one of them I thought was kind of interesting. It said, when the state tells you it's dangerous to go golf alone or fish alone or be in a motorboat alone, but the governor can get his stage makeup done and hair done for 5 TV appearances a week, it's not about your health.
Well, Terry, I think anyone with at least 2 brain cells to rub together must by now have figured out, with all of the bastardizations that are going on as far as rules for this class, rules for that class, rules for these people, rules for that people, anyone would have to understand that this has nothing to do with health. There is a virus, and I believe it was man-made. I believe it was created in a laboratory. I believe there's patents on it, and that most bioweapons do have a patent. So I don't believe it's been about health from the beginning, but I am firmly convinced that it's about control. I've said years ago that gun control was not about guns. It was about control. Government incessantly, from its very creation, moves to gather more and more and more power. And several of our people that we refer to as founders, and mostly almost 100% of them were anti-federalists, complained about the ability that this Constitution provided for government to continually increase its powers outside of the realm of the people. And, of course, again, you and I have talked about it. We have the right to petition for a redress of grievances. But the Supreme Court has said, well, yeah, you have a right to petition, but we don't have to answer because we're not required to by the Constitution. So petition all you want. So,
back when those dealerships were shut down, Steve Pigeon was one of the attorneys that filed a lawsuit against the government on behalf of these of the conservative owned dealerships, and the courts threw it out saying they did not have standing.
Well, were you surprised?
Well, it's insane, but it obviously woke me up to just how corrupt the judiciary is, because, I mean, if you've lost your dealership, here you've invested millions of dollars in opening up a huge car dealership, and they're telling you you don't have standing. I mean, were they injured? I mean, they were severely injured financially, and the court would not hear the case, saying they didn't have standing. I mean, that to me was the ultimate to show that the courts are not about justice and certainly not about common law by any means. It was over the top for me when I saw that happen.
Well,
here you are showing us that this really started all the way back at 1787.
Of course, it started during that time frame. And there's a couple of things a couple of things I would like to bring up. And it's just questions that I ask people. And I don't mean to be adversarial speak to anyone, to speak down to them, but they're just simple questions that I like to ask people who tell me how wonderful this Constitution is. And so, but we'll get into that. Let's move on to this one, number 11. And it says that in controversies respecting property and in suits between man and man, the ancient trial by jury is preferable to any other and ought to be held sacred. Well, I would like to throw in there that both James Madison, who I hold little regard for, and Thomas Jefferson, who I hold in much higher esteem, both made the comment that the final arbiter of what is and what is not constitutional in America is the individual operating through the jury, be it Pettit or Grant. And they are the final arbiters, not nine black-robed, supremes who are all nine politically connected lawyers who are elected for life, and you have no recourse. I think it was Sentinel said, no, it's Brutus, who said that the Supreme Court, that they have no restrictions other than heaven. And how can you have a government where one person in a 5-4 vote can determine what is legal and what is not legal for 333 million people? And tell me that that system was designed to be fair. Number 12, that the freedom of the press is one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments. Of course, you know, we've gotten around that because the government now owns the media. And I was talking to a friend today, and that, what was it, in the 80s and 90s, we always heard, well, we've got that left-wing media, and the others, that depended on who was in power. Oh, it's a right-wing media. No, it's a left-wing media. People, it is a government-owned media. And we can go all the way back to 1981 to Casey, the director of the CIA, when he said, and it is documented, we will know that our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. And I believe they've attained that goal. Number 13, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people. Wow. The militia is the body of the people. Trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. And here's the one where all the conservatives get tongue-tied. Standing armies in time of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty. And that, in all cases, the military should be under the strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. I don't think there'll ever be any argument over that. Number 15, that the people have a right to uniform government. I think we could find that in the Constitution, being Article 4, Section 2. Therefore, that no government separate from or independent of the government of Virginia ought to be erected or established within the limits thereof. Okay, number 15, that no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue, and by frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. Well, that one went out the window, I think, about 3 days after he wrote it.
Can you kind of park on that one? I think that one's one of those that people are going to go, what did he just say?
Okay, let me reiterate that no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a firm adherence to justice, which you just said that judges can throw justice out the window. So we certainly don't have that. Moderation. Do we have moderation in government today? Temperance, frugality, and virtue. Do we have virtue in our government today?
Well,
currents to fundamental
let's look at moderation for a minute. Moderation, how is moderation defined today? How would you define moderation? What do you think he meant by moderation when he said it? Because today, moderation is defined by the left and the right. So the whole term moderation is really, where are you on that scale of left and right? And there's really not any difference in the left and right because they're both creating debt. To me, moderation would start by keeping the expenses of the government in a moderate level that is contained within the delineated powers of the Constitution, and neither party come close to that. So what the heck is moderation? What's the difference between moderation when he wrote it and what's perceived today?
Well, the first thing I'd like to address is you prompted a question that I asked some folks today. And I said, why is it that the conservative of 2020 is way to the left of the liberals of 1960? Does that define moderation? Have we moderated strictly to the leftist viewpoint? Because I promise you, you look at the speeches of JFK today, and if those were uttered by a by anyone today, they would be considered far right wing. So where have we moderated to, Terry? And I think your question is very valid. But when I think of moderation, I also think of a phrase that has just been bastardized all over the place, and that is general welfare. And we've got the general welfare clause, which was inserted into our Constitution by the Committee of Style and not by the Committee of the Whole. We'll go into that at some point. But the General Welfare Clause was also in the Articles of Confederation. But I think it is important that we not just look at the words or the phrase, but to go back to what the people at the time the Articles of Confederation was debated, what did they say? Because they claimed that the General Welfare Clause was picked directly from the Articles to defend it. So what did the men who were writing the Articles of Confederation say about general welfare? I think that is crucial. And they said to establish the general welfare, whatever act the government does cannot benefit one man over another. And it can't take from one man and give to another man or provide one person with more benefits than it does someone else. So if we went by the definition of the people who created the general welfare clause, the government of today has shot that to hell, because they've used the general welfare clause to justify anything they want to do. And they haven't met the definition that was used when it was actually placed into the Articles of Confederation. Have I jumped too far away from moderation here? I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I don't want to break your stride. I just think that it's worth a couple of these situations to really get a good clear point of what was intended.
Right. I can't agree more. What about temperance? How are we as far as temperance in government today? And if we move to frugality, oh, my goodness. I have read some estimates that within this coronavirus pandemic hoax on the American public, that the government has increased our debt somewhere between $2.8 and $5 trillion in something a little over 2.5 months. Is that frugal?
I think it's more than that.
Well, that was just what I read today, and either one's totally unacceptable, Terry. And if we go to virtue and government are mutually exclusive, in my opinion. And then we go to frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. And have we even been in the neighborhood of our fundamental principles in the last 20 to 30 years? I think not.
Or last 150 years.
Yeah, well, that's pretty close. Moving to 16, I think we'll have a good discussion with this one. That religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it, can be directed by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience, and that it is the mutual duty of all, forbearance, love, and charity towards each other. So what are your thoughts there, Terry?
Well, that letter from Jefferson that's been misinterpreted, you know, the whole separation of church and state thing has been just turned on its head. It's upside down. It's backwards. It's to keep
the
government out of the yeah. And we did a whole show on that once upon a time back a few years ago. So, I mean, we could certainly go there, but to make a long story short, people have been misled on that issue, and it's typical of how this corrupt government misleads people on what the original intent of things was. So,
well, I thought
did
it
that
was
answer your question?
Yes, sir. I thought for Mason it was, having read a lot of his writings, and I like George Mason, I like what he said at the Constitutional Convention, I like for what he stood up for, but I am surprised that he used the phrase that we have a mutual duty to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity towards each other. Because as you and I have discussed before, a number of these founders were not Christian. Now, they've taken us down the road since I was a kid in Sunday school and other places saying that they were, but the evidence is just not there.
You know,
and
I'm starting to have a lot bigger problem with the term founders, because the people that founded this country certainly were mostly Christians. They came here for religious freedom. These guys that put these documents together and put this supposed trust agreement or employment agreement together that we call a constitution, I think of them less and less as founders. What's a proper term? What's a better? Do you have a better term than founders? Because these guys, you know, these guys were manipulators and slick talking lawyers and banksters and. But they jacked with what the people really wanted here as a founding for this country. Did they not?
Well, I think, in my mind, Terry, the founders of this country, if we want to take it to individuals, I consider the founders to be Samuel Adams, to be the Sons of Liberty, to be those people who from 1765 to 1783 basically were in the front lines of protesting against the taxes of the king, starting with Patrick Henry at the House of Burgesses in his objections.
You're breaking up.
Any better now?
No, I'm not here. Yes.
Okay. So the leaders of the of the actual fighting, the people who started with the protest of the Stamp Act, the Sons of Liberty, to me, those are the people that we must, in my mind, are the founders. Now, I have heard the term on the people in the Constitutional Convention where they have been referred to as framers, and I will go along with that. But if you tell me that we're going to group Henry and James Madison, both under the phrase founders, I'm going to object vociferously because they were polar opposites of what they desired for the people, and I can prove that in their own words. And if we're going to throw in other people, I mean, you know, if you're going to throw in Gouverneur Morris or Robert Morris and throw them in with Samuel Adams or Paul Revere or John Hancock, if you're going to put those people in one group and label them founders, I will again be objecting because they do not fit, because their purposes were different. If you want to call Dr. Joseph Warren a founder, I will be 100% in your corner. But if you want to call some of the other Federalists, Edmund Pendleton, for example, if you want to call him a founder, I will disagree. And I think we have disillusioned the American public with that phrase founders, and we have been for as long as I can remember, because when someone says founders, everybody hits a knee. And that is just wrong, because many of these people wanted a monarchy. And I'm sure today people call Alexander Hamilton a founder. Founder of what? You know, he created.
Well, he founded the first central bank.
Well, not the first one, the second one.
Okay.
It's called the first bank, but the Articles of Confederation during the war, Revolutionary War, they had a bank, the first central bank called the Bank of North America. And it was in effect from 1781 to 1785, and its charter expired. And by the time its charter expired, we were so far in debt, it was incredible. Those central banks lead to corruption. It's a matter of history. And so that, to me, is where our problems exist as far as founders. And I thank you for bringing that up, Terry. You know, we have a founder, if you will, and I will give him credit, and most people have never heard of him, is Samuel Bryan. And Samuel Bryan from Pennsylvania. He wrote as the anti-federalist sentinel. And he makes a valid case that two of the other founders who were at the Constitutional Convention, Robert Morris and Gouverneur Morris, no relation. One was financed, the other one was his assistant. And Sentinel makes one heck of a case that both of them embezzled millions of dollars during the Revolutionary War. He also makes a heck of a case that when they got to the Constitutional Convention, they provided two parts in the Constitution to cover their crimes, because they were allowed to create the compact and they were allowed to cover up their own crimes and to maybe use the Constitution to do it. And they, and Sentinel claimed that they used Article 6, Section 1, in which states, and I will paraphrase, that all debts against the United States must be paid. And they conveniently left out that all debts to the United States must be paid. So how do you come out with a fair adjustment if you only say that the bills you owe have to be paid, but the bill somebody, the money somebody owes you doesn't have to be paid in your constitution? Were they protecting themselves from the money they had embezzled? And then he also says that, and one of the things that we look at today and we say, hey, this is a great thing to have. Samuel Bryan in his Sentinel papers said that they also put in the no ex post facto laws to cover themselves for their embezzlement, which means that once the Constitution was ratified, they couldn't be charged for anything they'd done before. That's pretty convenient if you're writing the laws to protect yourself. Now, is that true or is it not true? There's not enough records back then to actually prove that. But I would ask people who would say, well, what does Samuel Bryan know? I would tell you to go read Samuel Bryan's, the Sentinel's essays, 16 through 23. And he provides one heck of a case. But then I'm going to tell you that if you would like to buy a book of all 20 of Samuel Bryan's essays in it today, Amazon has it for $930. So how many people do you think will go buy it?
It's certainly outside of my capability.
Well, do you think that's by design? How could a little small book, and it's, I forgot how many pages it has. I've got one, and I certainly didn't pay that price for it many years ago. But we go back to 1984, and we understand, reading 1984, I'm sorry, and we understand that what they did is they got rid of any documents in the book 1984 that would make the government look bad. Well, Samuel Bryan's writings certainly make the founders look bad, if we want to call Robert Morris and Gouverneur Morris founders. Certainly implicates them, and he draws one heck of a case that they had embezzled money. And we do know that they were, when everyone else, or not everyone else, but a lot of people in the country were drained by the war, those two men were quite wealthy. And Gouverneur Morris took a tour of Europe shortly after the war was over. You know, he had money from somewhere. And we know that Robert Morris bought millions of acres of land. I did say millions with an M. Well, how, if those two men were suspected of being embezzlers, why were they at the Constitutional Convention to start with? Why were they picked? And there's so many things there, Terry, and these are the questions I ask, not to be contradictory to people or not to be adversarial, except to ask simple questions. And those questions would be, we know that this country was founded, again, using that phrase, by a group of people who basically opposed excessive taxation. We know that the Stamp Act was what prompted Patrick Henry to make his appeal which quickly spread across all 13 states, and I've documented that, quickly spread across. Samuel Adams found where Patrick Henry found a copy of the motions he had made at the Virginia House of Burgesses, published them all through Massachusetts, and they ended up in Pennsylvania. They ended up everywhere, and people unified in a revolt against taxation. And we could say that this country was found paired in Philadelphia, and, well, ironically, Philadelphia was the financial center of America during that time frame. So the Constitution, the first power, the very first power granted to Congress, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, provided the government with the unlimited power of taxation. We had fought a war against the strongest military on the planet because of excessive taxation, and then our Constitution, with the very first power given to Congress, gives them the power to tax unlimited, limited taxation whatsoever.
How did that Go contrast ahead. With the Articles of Confederation?
Well, the Articles of Confederation, taxation had to be by states. And there were some problems with that. You can't ignore that as an honest historian. There were some problems because some of the states had paid their taxes. Virginia had paid all of her taxes. Some other states like Georgia and I think it was New Hampshire had paid none of their taxes, none of their requisite taxes. And yes, there needed to be some form to set up to pay the bills for the country. There needed to be that, but it did not need to be unlimited taxation, and it did not need to be any form of taxation that was desired. And so when you look at that and think that we went to war and decided to fight the biggest guy on the block because of the Stamp Act. And then how does that revert to a group of people that were willing to accept unlimited taxation? We were fighting against the King George III because he had a 6% tax. How much do you people pay in taxes today? I think almost
well, people
everyone
don't know.
I know.
People
well,
don't know
true.
How much they're paying in tax today. Because,
well,
because
there's so many hidden taxes. And that's exactly correct. And we look at two of the first revolts in America, Shays Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion, were over taxes. You had a group of people who had just gone to war with England and King George, and now they were being taxed by the people who were their government and being taxed at a higher rate than King George had. You think you might understand why these people were upset? The people in Pennsylvania. Go ahead.
Let me throw a shockwave out there for people. When they just printed, in essence, or created, if not printed, but created an additional amount of money or currency, which is the correct term, money is not the right term. They've just created an additional amount of currency of somewhere in the range between $6 and $8 trillion. That's really closer to the number here just in the last few months that they've increased the currency by that much money or that much amount. That represents a tax on the people because it is in real terms. Your wealth was just devalued in purchasing power by that, and that represents a hidden tax. Inflation is a hidden tax. Inflation is not caused by product going up in price. Inflation is created by the devaluing or reduction in purchasing power of what is currently called the U.S. dollar. That is one of the biggest hidden taxes that exist And I'm telling people today that's listening to this, that $6 to $8 trillion is a tax. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, you couldn't be more correct. And I, every time that subject is broached, I think of the creator of the Bank of England, one William Paterson, in 1694, who said, and I quote, "We have the benefit of all the money we create out of nothing." So when this country decided that they needed to print $6 to $8, or to use a computer keystroke, to create $6 to $8 trillion, as you mentioned, Terry, did they have $6 to $8 trillion in gold or silver to back that money?
That was a rhetorical question, wasn't it?
And I know that at some point, Terry, that we will get into it, but a thought, and you and I have talked about it, was Article 6, Section 3 of the Constitution, and you mentioned before about that we were a Christian nation at that time, and 12 out of 13 states, and I could read them, a couple of those states, if anyone desires, at some future show, but 12 of the 13 states in 1787 had a religious oath to the Christian God in their constitution. If you took if you won an elective office or were appointed to an office in the government in 12 of those 13 states, you had to take an oath to the Christian God. And the Article 6, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution only took that away from the federal government, but it took it away from all the states. Now, here's a question that I've had for years, and I ask people, and I get that deer in the headlights look. Read Article 6, Section 3, and tell me that how that comports with the First Commandment. Would you like to speak to that, Terry?
Article 3, what?
Article 6, Clause 3, which does away with any religious oath. And that basically was not only at the federal level, but at the state level. So with Article 6, Clause 3, when it was ratified, it destroyed every Christian oath in 12 states.
You know, this whole separation of church and state thing has been puzzling to me, the way some people have looked at it. Even men who were like on a church council or an elder of a conservative church, of a fundamental church, who was involved in the education, actually, public education. They saw that as being a positive thing because it supposedly supported religious freedom. But what we see in reality is that that's not true. It doesn't support religious freedom. Unless you're on the right side of that opinion, which basically are those that are either atheistic or anybody that's a distraction from the Creator, Father in Heaven, they are free. They're free to read the Quran, but they're not free to read Scripture in our school system, you know. But I've heard this argument presented by actually an educator who was also on a church council, where they thought it was a good thing because they didn't want other religions to be able to be presented. But in fact, they are. They allow it all the time. Anyway,
well, Terry, one of the things One of the things I found most remarkable in going back and looking at official documents, and right now I have to confess that my memory fails me and I cannot remember the gentleman's name from the South Carolina ratification convention where they were ratifying the Constitution. I was trying to think of the gentleman's name, and I apologize for not being able to do that, but I remember very distinctly.
You broke up.
Okay, where should I start from? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. This gentleman at the South Carolina Ratification Convention made the statement that if Article 6, Clause 3, became parts of the Constitution at some time in the future, that our government would be composed of non-believers and Muslims. 233 years ago, some guy in South Carolina made that prediction. And recently, I looked at a list of all of the avowed Muslims who are running for public office in America or either hold office in America, and it's shocking. If you don't believe it, go look. But this man, and I think his name was Henry Abbott. I may be wrong, but that's what sticks in my head right now. But he said, if we adopt this clause and allow it to stand in our Constitution, at some point in time, our government will be run by non-believers and Muslims.
And who was the – I don't remember the guy's name, but it was before Obama that they took their oath of office by putting their hand on a Koran. I believe it was about, 22 years ago, something like that?
If I'm not mistaken, go ahead.
The Koran stands in direct contrast to the Constitution and certainly to the Articles of Confederation and to the Declaration of Independence. It is a political doctrine.
Well, let's not forget, too, that George W. Bush told us that Christians and Muslims worship the same God.
Yeah, I know. You're about to get me on a soapbox.
Well, it's true. And because I have the direct quote. And so how could this gentleman in Henry Abbott, and again, I may be wrong on the name, how could he 230 some years ago predict that if we dropped that religious oath from our states and our federal government, from that oath to the Christian God, and not to the Unitarian God or the Deist God, but the Christian God, if we drop that oath, that sometime our government would be run by non-believers and Muslims?
Well, I don't know if he was being fear-mongering at the time or not, but it was certainly a prophetic statement. You know, maybe the man didn't even come out with those words. Maybe his tongue was being controlled by the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit.
Well, I think we would have to call him a man of wisdom, or a man with eyes to the future. Anyway, or whatever phrase you want to use. But when I first read that, Terry, several years ago, when I first read that from the South Carolina Ratification Convention, I was stunned.
Well, he pegged it. And it's insane. I mean, it's literally criminally insane. I'm just going to say it. The most exclusive figure in history that I know of is Yahshua, the son of our Father in heaven, also known as Jesus the Christ. His birth name was Yahshua. He was an exclusive character. he was a divider. Because you were either on his side and the father's side, or you were on some other side. And all of these world religions, all of them, are a distraction from the one true religion. There's just no two ways about it. And all you have to do is read the scriptures, because it tells you just the same thing. And these people that want to be a whole world church or a one world religion or let's all get along and unite business, if you are not united with the Son, the Messiah, you're united with their enemy, of his enemy, and that's the devil. So there's your choice. I'll get off my soapbox. Let's wrap it up in about 4 or 5 minutes, okay?
Well, I checked just to make sure, and it looks like Mr. Abbott, the name was correct, although there are two spellings, A-B-B-O-T and A-B-B-O-T-T, at various places, and he was born in 1740 and died in 1791, and guess what? Terry, he was a Baptist minister. A revolutionary patriot who was born in London, England. His father was the Reverend John Abbott, a minor or petty canon of the St. Paul's Cathedral and rector of the City Church of St. Michael's in London.
He'd roll over in his grave a couple of times if he heard what some of the Baptist ministers today are saying.
Oh, I know. Absolutely. And it says he became stronger in the Calvinist phrase, but Calvinist particular Baptist. And he was ordained. He was also a traveling evangelist. And it says he undoubtedly became well-known to congregations on both sides of the river, and that was in the Camden, South Carolina area. He served briefly as a minister for a group of Tar River, and in 1765, accepted an invitation to become pastor of the Shiloh Church in Pasquotank County, following the death of the previous minister.
I'm gonna put a wager out here. You've got me wagering on some things, so I'm gonna put a wager out here. My wager is that this man had a historical view of prophecy. I guarantee you, this man knew exactly who the little horned beast was in Scripture, and he knew also that they were already in the tribulation back at that time, and that it was not some 3.5 year or 7 year period off in the future. I guarantee you this man understood the lies of the Jesuits who came out and fomented the Scofield Bible situation. So there you have it. This man was a Baptist preacher at that time. He would reject what a lot of Baptist preachers are saying in the pulpits today.
Well, here's a question for you,
Terry. 2 minutes.
We
got about 2 minutes, Mike. Go ahead.
Here's your question. Would you call Henry Abbott a founder?
I'm not sure how to answer that question because I don't mean to be tongue-tied, but I...
Well, that was just what popped into my mind. Would we call someone that prophetic, which I had never heard of in high school or college or elementary school, would we call someone who was that prophetic at the ratification convention, would we call them, and I've been saying South Carolina, I think it was North Carolina, I apologize, but... would we have called him a founder? I certainly have never seen his name mentioned among the founders.
I would say this. I would consider him more a founder than many who are called founders.
Well, I will agree with that.
Wrap it up.
So where are we, my friend? Well, I just would like for everyone to take some time and to actually think about the questions I've asked. Don't rush out to defend the Constitution because your seventh grade teacher told you it was inspired by God or you heard it in Sunday school. Examine the letters among the founders. Find out why these people put these unrestricted taxation into a constitution for a country that had gone to war to stop the exact same thing. Just have an inquisitive mind. Don't suffer from cognitive dissonance where if you hear something that you don't want to believe, you just discount it out of hand. Be intelligent. Learn. Study.
We didn't open this show with a prayer. I'm going to close it with one real quick.
All right, sir. Go to it.
Mike, thanks. This was awesome. I really enjoyed our discussion and what you presented, and I know we'll pick up where we left off next week, I hope. Almighty Father in heaven,
yes,
we're just so thankful for the opportunity to bring truth to people. And we just pray that we are handling the truth here, that we are presenting the truth in a way that meets your desire and in your desire. We thank you for watching over us and helping us not have technical difficulties here, but we're thankful for those listeners who have ears that can hear. And I'm very thankful for my brother, Michael Gaddy. And it's just such a pleasure that you've given us to work together and watch over our listeners. And until next week, this has been Handling the Truth. Thank you for joining us. Good night, Mike.
Good night, sir.
In a no-win situation, you sold out to the devil and the price was our young men. If it's trouble that we're feeling, I'm the first one volunteering, and I don't think nobody here would hesitate to go to war. But in the cause of freedom, they're gonna be there when